Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz, Hawaii Talks on The Conversation. Today we take a look at food insecurity on the Big Island and what community organizers there are doing to address it. We check in with a small business owner on Kauai who talks about the challenges of running a community market in a food desert. And fuel made from plants and used cooking oil will power airline flights in the coming months. We learn what went into making the state's largest renewable fuels manufacturing facility. We meet a native crimson bird on this week's Manu Minute that produces hundreds of unique calls. And we get a preview of a special exhibit in London that will showcase the relationship between Hawaii and Great Britain. It centers around a first visit from Hawaiian ali'i who tragically died on that trip. The exhibit opens at the British Museum this month. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. You may not know, but Hawaii County has the highest rate of food insecurity in the state. It's at 43%. HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote spent time with a number of community groups working to tackle the issue. They just got help from the county to the tune of $500,000. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so give us a sense as to what's happening there.
Yeah, so I talked to community groups that are recipients of funding from the county as part of their community food security grant program. This is $500,000 divvied up over 29 organizations that are really focused on how they can help their immediate neighborhood, their immediate community. And across the board, they are reporting demand for food services at near pandemic levels. And they're working really hard to meet that demand. But when you break it down, the specific challenges that they're facing and the solutions that they're coming up with really vary. So one person I talked to was Claudia Zeroli, who coordinates the Puna Makaukau for an Acres Resilience Hub. And they're in Upper Puna, which was an area that was spared during the destructive lava flows that hit Lower Puna in 2018. But as a result of that disaster, Zeroli says that a lot of people have moved into their community since that time, and their population has doubled. So that means that they're trying to feed more people, but they're also trying to think about what the next disaster could be like. And that's part of the motivation that they're using to build out their cold storage with county funds.
We're one of those communities that has a one way in and one way out. There's a whole network of subdivisions up here that rely on one road for ingress and egress. And so we really need to be able to feed people in a long-term 72-hour or better response, which falls on our CERT team and falls on our emergency food volunteers and all of the coordination that requires to be able to stand up and feed people. So we've been working on our emergency plan, our community plan, so that we can get out there and feed people and have barbecues and have people empty their freezers into the hub so that we can distribute food before it spoils.
Yeah, one way in, one way out. You're really vulnerable.
Yeah, and not every community, of course, has to contend with a volcanic eruption, but disaster preparation is something that's on a lot of people's minds. So if you go 2 hours north to the other side of the island, the Kohala Resilience Hub is doing something really unique with the county funds that they got. They're putting it towards 4 community canning classes. And I talked with their director, Kathleen Matsuda, who thinks that, you know, giving people the skills that they need to can fresh produce is going to give them more resources, not just on the day-to-day, but during a disaster, right? So we've all heard that you're supposed to keep 14 days worth of food on hand. And for me, that's just beans. It's just straight beans. But Kathleen is envisioning this world where that can include tomatoes you canned yourself, or cucumbers you pickled, or fresh jam that you have. And she says in Hawi, this North Hawaii agricultural region where the hub is based, there are a lot of families that don't have enough, but there is also abundance if you know where to look for it.
Every day someone passes this neighbor's house and it was full of calamansi. And so it's like, what do you do with all this overabundance of fruits and vegetables? And so one day we just went to pick and then just happened to find out that one of the our canners, that was her house. So she loved it that we got to pick the calamansi, and then we can made calamansi marmalade. And so just using it, not to waste the overabundance of fruits that we have.
Yeah, that's smart, you know, classes on canning.
Yeah, Bina'alehu Resilience Hub is also trying to make people more self-sufficient. This is an agricultural region where most employment is seasonal. And so they want to offer farming classes to help people grow more of their own food. And they just received $25,000 from the county to help out build out their commercial space, a kitchen that will be available to the public. And Marcia Masters, who heads that up, she thinks that that kitchen could not only help keep people fed, but it could also be an economic driver in the area.
Community members will be able to come in, and if they need storage for in the refrigerator or the freezer, you know, if they have animals or whatever, that they can use our facilities. And also for some cottage industries, if people want to make lillicoy butter, or my gals that work for us in the kitchen keep thinking about smoked meat. Oh, yes, we'll have smoked meat. So looking ahead to creating a little bit more economic growth in the community.
And are they doing anything to target, you know, like at-risk groups, so kupuna, keiki, that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So this depends on where you're at. A community like Waimea, which is served by St. James Parish, that has a high rate of kupuna who are housebound, so they started delivery services. And then in Kona, there is this effort to tie in food access directly to healthcare. So that's a big focus of the work of the West Hawaii Regional Hospital Foundation, which oversees Kona Community Hospital. They are saying that in their ER, half of the people who come in on any given day are screening as food insecure. So they've taken the step of partnering with a community group, Kua'o Kana Ui Ui, which owns 30 acres of farmland directly above the hospital in Kalaikikua. And with county funds and other awards and donations, they've been building a brand new community commercial kitchen on that land, which they're going to open up in 2026, and it will help the hospital prepare more to-go meals with locally grown food. So I talked to the hospital's chief operation officer, Amy Feely Austin, and she says one of the groups that they'll be able to better serve is kupuna, who are treated at the hospital and then discharged and need to go home to recover but don't have any prepared meals at home. And they're also hoping that they might be able to make more meals for students in the area.
One place that we can make sure that kiddos get food is at school. On this side of the island, many of our charter schools in particular do not have food programs because they don't have the infrastructure at their facilities to cook meals. And they have a smaller enrollment, so they don't have those resources. And for several years, some of the schools have been inquiring as to whether or not that's something that we might be able to address at the hospital, but we didn't really have space in our hospital kitchen to do anything other than produce food for the hospital. So this partnership is actually allowing us to access this brand new, very, very large commercial kitchen that we can utilize to produce meals for kids as well.
I must say, this is pretty impressive, you know, very thoughtful and custom solutions to the areas and their needs.
Yeah, so the food baskets help the county administer these funds, and people are probably familiar with them. They're the largest food provider in the area, but they're based only in Kona and Hilo. That's where their warehouses are. And they said these community groups, they're going to come up with the most effective solutions for their community because that's where they're based. They know their neighbors, they know what the need is. And I think the examples that came up in the conversations that I had really supported that.
Yeah, really amazing. Well, thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote with a story about food insecurity on the Big Island.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
If you're old enough, you'll remember the video rental shop. They were everywhere. In France, a handful of them are still open, VHS tapes included, and they're offering more than just nostalgia.
It's like a library, and it's very exciting to come in and try to make a decision. And so much more curated than Netflix.
Hear that story next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
We continue on this topic of food. Many small businesses in Hawaii are facing a fresh round of challenges as they enter the new year. There's an increase in the state minimum wage, stubborn inflation, and the ongoing uncertainty around President Donald Trump's tariffs. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson checked in with Joelle Edwards, the owner of Waianae County Market on the North Shore of Kauai. The store had been in the community for over 125 years. The previous owner ran it for nearly five decades. Edward spoke just outside the store among the resident chickens and took stock of the business that she and her children had been running for the past 7 years.
It just kind of happened. I was working in food insecurity with the County of Kauai and other organizations. We had gone through a big flood here up in Waianae, Haena. There is some food insecurity here. Also, it's a food desert. The other local grocery store is Big Save, which is in Hanalei, which is a drive away. We don't have public transportation there. My son actually said when Janet retired, he's like, let's try our hand at it. So we took the plunge and decided to open up a community market and actually bring more food down here than had been here in the past. I think it had already been a food market, and then it just kind of had transitioned to more convenience. Our goal was to actually bring actual like milk and bread and cheese and breads and meats and as well as pantry items, but also locally sourced and locally made products.
Yeah, because that's a balancing act, right? In terms of trying to be there for perhaps visitors that might be in the area, but also be there, maybe primarily be there for people who live in the area that are coping with that food desert.
Yeah, absolutely. And being able to have EBT was priority number one, having nutritious food, obviously. So we didn't even open until we knew that we could accept the EBT. We're also kind of have been a depository for food support and food relief. I am partnering with the Hawaii Food Bank. We've been working on this for quite a while, but we're going to have their mobile food pantry come the last Wednesday of every month. And I think when you're thinking about what grocery store brings a food pantry in, which takes your sales away, but it really speaks to our mission, providing food to folks that don't have it. And there's a food distribution that happens in Hanalei on Thursdays. And I was watching most of my community drive past my store on Thursdays. And I was like, we should just do it here. We should just do it here. Everybody's in the backs of trucks and just make it easier. So I'm really grateful for that partnership with Hawaii Food Bank.
It sounds like you have a bigger vision for what the store can be in the community beyond just a grocery store, right? Trying to be there for the community in the most expansive way possible.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is a school bus stop here as well. I mean, this is a rural community. We're pretty far and set before behind. And so the kids get the school bus here. So we try to do a lot of events for our keiki up here. We do movie nights in our back parking lot where we have a 30-foot blow-up movie screen and families ride their bikes or their quads or their mules. And everybody kind of comes in and we set up fire pits and we do movie nights. So we really try to make it a hub. I'm really grateful. I have really great tenants here. I have The Haven is a coffee shop, and the two of us support other local businesses by doing pop-up shops and having those vendors be able to come in and have maybe a different audience and bring people this way as well. So our main goal is not only supporting the community, but supporting community makers and producers and small business people and all that as well.
And as I understand it, an emphasis on hiring women as well.
Yeah. So all women employees, all of our ladies live in the community. It was really important for us to be job producers. We're small, there's five of us, but to be able to pay a living wage, you know, I'm really grateful as that wage goes up. But I will say that our wage is well past what it just became. And it's well past what the national average is, but higher than what California is. It was important to us that people have a living wage. That's one of the hardest things here in Hawaii, obviously.
And you're talking about the minimum wage being, you're already well above the new minimum wage that just kicked in.
Well above the 16, yeah.
And so you've got the cost of employees, which is always one of the biggest costs that employers face, but also you've been dealing with inflation. So talk about inflation on the wholesale side of things.
Well, I mean, everything has gone up, right? It's absorbing rising costs when you run a small business. So it's absorbing the rising cost of costs, shipping, insurance, payroll, and taxes, and also making a conscious choice to support local producers. The inter-island shipping is essential. There's for neighbor island and businesses, it's unavoidable. Right? There's no way we can get around it. And I had someone in the market yesterday and we're talking about local producers. And I said, yeah, but most of their goods still get packaged and those packages come on the barge. I have folks that, you know, jar things or even poi is going in a bag and the bag has to come somehow. So it's a line item that we can't eliminate the shipping, right? And then just the high cost of insurance. And that's everywhere from our property insurance to our TDI to our workman's comp. All those are rising together and we want to do everything above board. And so we're not paying people under the table in cash. And some folks are doing that to avoid these. But if my folks get hurt, we want to make certain that they have workman's comp and they have all those items as well. We're also rural. So we literally only have two vendors that deliver to us.
So there's a lot of going out to get the items that you stock in your shop.
Yeah. So after this interview today, I'll be going to a farmer's market where I'll meet every Tuesday. I meet with three vendors and I pick up there. Not too far. It's just in Waipa. But on Wednesdays is most of our farm goods come in on Wednesdays. And we graciously have an employee that takes that on. And so she starts her day early tomorrow and she hits all of our farms and picks up, you know, our eggs and our produce and local juices and jams and baked goods and pesto and goat cheese. And she kind of brings it all in. And then we meet with providers halfway sometimes, you know, large items. We have to go to Lihue and we just load up my little 2002 Toyota Tacoma and get it going on.
When you talked about rising costs on so many fronts, it'd be great if you could dial down on rising wholesale costs. Is there an item that you could point out as an example of how you've experienced an increase in cost and how you try to manage that for your customers?
Yeah, you know, we really had a mission that, especially when it was kids and coming in and we're like, dude, we want some things that are a dollar. Every kid knows that they go to their corner shop, right? And they just have a dollar and you don't always want to buy candy, but so we're like the small cans of Pringles, that's a dollar. Aloha made, right? It should be a dollar. A can of soda, we wanted it to be a dollar. When we first went into business 5 years ago, the wholesale cost of a can of Pepsi was about 41 cents. And we're like, hey, that's perfect. That's almost 100% markup. We can justify that. The cost of that same can is now 84 cents. Everything has gone up in the hundreds. It's not these small increments. And this year we're hearing from a lot of vendors that are like, hey, due to the tariffs, their wholesale price, it's a lower discount than it used to be to order wholesale. So it's a higher cost for us because they're paying higher costs. And, you know, farmers, makers, food producers are all facing higher fuel and shipping costs. They're also rising insurance premiums, increased labor, higher land and operational costs. So when their costs rise, wholesale costs rise, and it's not because everybody's out here just to be a profit taker, it's survival, basically. So the local producers aren't immune. They're carrying the same weight, just kind of is a domino effect.
Yeah, that's a great reminder that even if you're looking at a local product, locally produced, tariffs can still play a part. Are there other areas where you're seeing tariffs play a part or have an effect?
You know, you had heard it on the news, you're hearing about it. And I would say in the last 6 months, I'm actually hearing vendors say they're experiencing it, that it's actually affecting them and multiple producers. And I've had other small business folks and small retailers saying, yeah, it's items that we used to have from the shipping cost to the tariff cost is changing significantly. And, you know, the small and mid business, you know, we're the bridge between these really small producers and the community, right? And getting it out to the community. And, you know, that bridge is significantly under strain right now. It's strained.
Do you feel like there are other challenges you're facing as you head into this new year and you sort of take stock of where you are? Are there other challenges that you're facing or that you would just highlight in general terms that you think you and other small businesses might be facing in the state?
I know that when I talk to other small businesses, it's almost like an ethical decision because you're constantly trying to make a decision on what you can absorb. So our community isn't taking the hit. And specifically when the federal shutdown happened and the SNAP and the EBT happened, and we're seeing all that. And, you know, the last thing you want, but our prices are going up. And so you have to make this like conscious decision. And it is hard. And specifically in this community, it can be incredibly hard. Do you pass it on to visitors? How does that look? And, you know, we really reclaim this space for the local community and a local market. Most of our business is community-based. We love visitors when they come through. They're lovely and they love the charm of being in an old, you know, historic market. And we rarely get a lot of pushback. One thing is our market's so small that we don't have price tags on anything. And we remind people if we had to tag everything, the price would just go up. It would cost us so much money just to tag everything. So we have no problem just telling you, we know what everything costs in there and we'll tell people, but we make certain that our locals get discount, you know, that Kamaaina rate, obviously on their check as well. And we're in a unique position that we do run a ledger and we run tabs for folks. Not everybody, you know, they could be short. And so we make certain that, you know, specifically at the end of the month, when EBT is about to run out, we'll start running some tabs for folks and making sure. But we also have very generous and lovely people that live in this community that we call it the Angel Fund. And we have people that just hand us amounts and it goes into the Angel Fund and that helps us pay other people's or assist folks that we know need assistance. And I'm so grateful to all those angels out there. Specifically during the holidays, they really came through and their generosity was unbelievable. Some days I want to do a hug counter. The amount of hugs that we get every day, or just watching our community greet one another, like to stand behind and see the greetings that happen and see these connections that people that have known each other 50, 60 years or, you know, longer, and watching their kids grow up and then the school bus comes in. And we're so fortunate to live where we live. I'm so grateful every day that I'm part of this community and have all these lovely people around me that love one another and treat each other so kindly and would do anything for anybody. It's amazing. It really is.
A hug counter. I like that idea. I give that chicken a hug. Yeah. That was Joelle Edwards, the owner of Wainiha County Market on the north shore of Kauai. She spoke with HPR's D.W. Gibson about the challenges facing small businesses as they begin the new year.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle-Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
Today on The Daily, as 2026 gets underway, so does a midterm election year for control of Congress, a campaign that will determine whether Democrats can operate as a check against the extraordinary power of President Trump. I'm Michael Barbaro. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating over 87 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Hawaiian and Alaska Airlines recently announced that its flights will soon be running on a biofuel blend made from plant oils and used cooking oil. It's the latest step to try out biodiesel, a greener alternative to conventional jet fuel. Par Hawaii converted part of its Kapolei refinery to be able to process plant and waste oils. It now says it will have the capacity to produce 60 million gallons of the sustainable fuel annually. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Par Hawaii President Eric Wright about his company's plans to deliver sustainable fuel to a quarter of Alaska and Hawaiian Airlines flights in the islands.
We first started to look at this, I think, in 2022, so almost 4 years ago now. And at that point in time, we signed a memorandum of understanding with Hawaiian Airlines to explore the feasibility of producing sustainable aviation fuel in Hawaii. And about a year later, 2023, probably sooner than we thought, actually, we were prepared to commit and make that investment, about $100 million investment to convert a portion of our plant in Kapolei, which makes the majority of the fuel that's used in Hawaii, to renewable fuels. And so this unit will come online in the first quarter, so in the coming months. It'll produce sustainable aviation fuel, but also a range of fuels, renewable diesel, a product called renewable naphtha that can be used for power generation, and even renewable propane.
So just to put this into context, that facility now that produces renewable fuels or that's going to early this year is the largest facility doing that in the state. What were some of the barriers in terms of scaling up?
Yeah, it takes a lot of energy and a lot of equipment to produce renewable fuel like this. First, you actually have to treat the oil that comes in, whether it's vegetable oil or waste oil. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to use water that's heated to about 450 degrees Fahrenheit. And then the reactions themselves operate at high pressure, high temperature. So to build a plant like this from scratch would be hundreds of millions of dollars, if not $1 billion. We were very fortunate here that we had some excess capacity that we could use. And so we're able to make this facility work for about $100 million. So we had this huge head start in the fact that we had all these tanks and all this equipment, and we're able to reuse that. There's only about 20 of these facilities in the United States across the whole country. And so I think we're very fortunate in Hawaii to, you know, have the ability to have a facility like this.
It just seems to me so much harder to do here than on the continent. If you think about the supply chain, if you think about space to grow some of the raw materials that might be turned into fuel. So how have you tackled some of those unique challenges?
You know, one of the advantages we had is we actually make hydrogen at our plant. And so we had some excess capacity for hydrogen. And so we're able to use that with little additional investment. And so that was a huge advantage. You know, and aside from that, just a lot of the infrastructure is already in place. So we are able to make sustainable aviation fuel, ship it to the airport down our pipeline with basically no additional cost. We can make renewable diesel and we can sell it to Hawaiian Electric and distribute it through the supply chain that we already have well established with them. So that's a big advantage, actually. A lot of the plants on the continent are located a long ways away from airports, a long ways away from the places where the fuel gets used. So we had an advantage. I guess smallness is an advantage because by definition, we're going to be very close to our customers here on an island.
And your mention of Hawaiian Electric answered another question I had, which is once you make sustainable aviation fuel, are there other comparable products you could be making for other industries here. It's not a zero-sum game.
That's right. Yeah. So the first stage when you produce these fuels, the first product you make is actually renewable diesel. And so that can go to a variety of uses. It can go to power generation. It can go to the shipping companies for ocean transportation. It can go to trucking. You have the option to essentially have the unit make all of that product. Or you can take it a step further and you actually crack that diesel molecule and you get sustainable aviation fuel. And as a byproduct, you get renewable naphtha. Most people haven't heard of naphtha, but naphtha is just low octane gasoline, just like the gasoline you put in your car. So that product can actually go to power generation. It's used on Kauai and the Big Island for power generation today. It's also used by Hawaii Gas to make the synthetic natural gas that gets used in Hawaii. Everything from cooking to water heating to the tiki torches on Waikiki. So those are the three principal fuels. And so they really, we have the ability to attack a lot of different sectors of Hawaii's economy and help them decarbonize.
And any plans to do that? I mean, what would the timeline for branching out into some of these other sectors look like?
Yeah. So we actually are in contract discussions with Hawaiian Electric right now. And there's an open docket at the Public Utilities Commission to review that. And we're in discussions with a number of other parties in the state here, but it would be too early for me to talk about that publicly.
And then just some baseline stats on sustainable aviation fuel, how that stacks up compared to conventional fuel. I believe I read that it can be up to 80% lower carbon emissions. But let's step back for a second, right? Because airline emissions are some of the biggest contributor to our carbon footprint locally and globally. So what does a step like this mean for decarbonizing and our goals as a state?
The first place to start is really to think about these sectors that are hard to decarbonize. And aviation is one of them. Electric airplanes, at least at commercial scale, are nowhere on the horizon at this point in time. And trucking's also hard to decarbonize, and shipping, and even the power sector, solar and wind have become very good options, but you still need a firm backbone on a day like today when it's cloudy to make sure that the grid has the power that it needs. In terms of our investment, the way I like to think about it and sort of put it in perspective, it's a small step forward, but we have the capability to produce about 25% of Hawaiian Airlines demand in Hawaii. So we'll have enough SAF to address up to 25% of what Hawaiian Airlines uses on a daily basis.
I'm curious, did the conversations change at all when the merger between Alaska Airlines and Hawaiian took place?
No, if anything, they got stronger. We've known the folks at Alaska Airlines for many years. We were familiar with some of their early work in sustainable aviation fuel. We knew the people involved. And so we really weren't worried at all when that merger was announced. In fact, we thought it would probably be a good thing. And I think so far it has proven to be a good thing.
The last thing I wanted to touch on was just the funding pathway, because, $100 million investment, this isn't cheap. But going into the legislative session, what are your hopes on that front?
Well, we were able to make this $100 million investment from our own balance sheet, from our corporate funds. We're part of a larger public company called Par Pacific Holdings. So we had the capacity to do that. But what it doesn't change is that these fuels are more expensive than conventional fuel. If you think about the fossil fuel industry, it's been around for 100 years. There's literally trillions of dollars that have been invested in the infrastructure. And you just don't have that with renewable fuels. So biofuels like this are typically $2 to $4 more expensive per gallon than conventional fuel. There are incentives that are available at the federal level, and they're still effective today, that get you about half the way there. They're worth about $1 to $2 a gallon. And so to make the cost competitive for the consumer, you really need support at the state level. So there are states that have these types of programs, Washington, Oregon, California. We have a very limited tax credit on the books today that doesn't really get used. And so we're hoping to reform that tax credit law and make it usable and make it accessible so that it's really about bringing down the cost for Hawaii consumers to use these fuels.
And anything else you'd want listeners to know? I can imagine someone taking a flight and not even realizing that it would be powered in part by more sustainable aviation fuel.
To me, I think the most exciting part of this is the potential to spur local agriculture. We have been working with Pono Pacific for the past 2 years. And the reality is we don't have enough land here in Hawaii to make all the renewable fuel from local feedstock. But we have an aspirational goal to get 25% of our feedstock from local sources. That'd be 15 million gallons a year of oil. So it's a very meaningful amount. The best way to do that, we think, is to use cover crops. So crops that rotate in between food crops. And so they don't really compete with food crops. They actually provide a revenue source for farmers that make it more profitable to put land into service and into food production. Out of all of this, that's really the most exciting part, is to kind of bring it all together, have farmers grow the oil crops here, and for us to make fuel out of them. And then there's a byproduct which you can use for animal feed. So there's just a great opportunity to create jobs and put a lot of land that is no longer in service back into service.
Thank you so much, Eric Wright.
Enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
That was PAR Hawaii President Eric Wright and HPR's Maddie Bender. Hawaiian and Alaska Airline flights will begin using sustainable aviation fuel produced by PAR Hawaii's Kapolei Refinery in the coming months. Full disclosure, PAR Hawaii is an HPR underwriter.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses designed to engage the mind and enrich lives. Classes begin February 2nd, OLLIUHM.org.
With Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in a New York court, who will lead the country now? President Trump says,
"So we are going to run the country until such time as we can do a safe, proper and judicious transition."
The legality, practicality, and morality of regime change in Venezuela. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, and we now go to University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart, who introduces us to a crimson honeycreeper in this week's Manu Minute.
The apapane is a direct descendant of a flock of finches that somehow flew from Asia over nearly 3,000 miles of open ocean and landed in the Hawaiian Islands more than 5 million years ago. It's one of over 55 species of birds, now known as the Hawaiian honeycreepers, that evolved from that original group. And nowadays, it's the only one left whose song can still be commonly heard on all the main Hawaiian islands, especially if you're in a forest where the ohia lehua are blooming, as their curved bills and brush-like tongues are perfectly adapted to forage on the nectar of these flowers. Even though apapane are a brilliant bright red in color, they are often more easily detected by their beautiful song, which has recently been found to vary between the islands, and even between different forest patches or kipuka on the same island. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Department of Biology at the University of Hawaii at Hilo.
Mm-hmm. London will showcase Hawaii starting next week. The British Museum opens its doors to a new exhibit titled Hawaii, A Kingdom Crossing Oceans. It explores the relationship between Hawaii and Great Britain. It will feature 150 treasures, among them gifts from Hawaii's ali'i over the years, and it will catalog its inventory of Hawaii artifacts, said to be close to 1,000 pieces. The show will feature a feather cape presented by King Kamehameha II on a visit 200 years ago. Tragically, King Liholiho and Queen Kwamamalu died from measles on that trip. So acknowledging that loss and the diplomatic relationship that followed is important. A key link to making this show happen is a former Bishop Museum curator who is now the curator and head of Oceania at the British Museum. This morning, we talked to Elise Christoph about what it took to mount this show.
It's been an amazing experience to first work at the Bishop Museum and then make my way here to London and, you know, work on this incredible collection that is here at the British Museum. The process of putting together the exhibition, Hawaii, A Kingdom Crossing Oceans, began around 2 years ago now, and it's been go, go, go since. The idea of an exhibition about Hawaii in collaboration with people in community, that's something that started in 2023. But truly the exhibition process itself began 2 years ago. So it's been a long journey.
Well, I understand that a part of this exhibit hinges on, you know, that first visit by our ali'i 200 years ago. And, you know, it was a tragic visit, but that really, you know, made the connections, I think, between the two nations.
Absolutely. So at the core of the exhibition is the story of Mo'i, Liholiho, and Kamamalu, and a delegation of 10 crossing a couple of oceans to come to the UK to seek alliance and protection from the British Crown. And this is really a story that we wanted to tell and honor and mark in that space. It's a story that's been very seldom told here in the UK and in Europe in general. And we felt that with that marker, the 200 years since the journey and the events that followed, this was really the right time to do this exhibition. So we organized the exhibition with this story as the core, as the sort of the main pico. And then we grew the story in concentric circles from that pico to think about that relationship before the time of Liholiho. Obviously, Kamehameha the first sort of formalized that relationship between the Hawaiian Kingdom and the United Kingdom. And then also moving forward, elements and stories that take place during Kamehameha III's reign and all the way sort of into the present, thinking about continued relationship with community and between community and the museum.
I understand that you are also going to be featuring some items from Bishop Museum to tell the backstory about the exchange and the relationship.
Absolutely. So something quite crucial for this exhibition is that we did not want to borrow additional ancestral works from Hawaii. We felt that it was important that we centered the collections that are here in London at the British Museum and in the Royal Collections when it came to mea kupuna or ancestral works. So from Bishop Museum, we borrowed British gifts given to ali'i by the British Crown. And what this does in this space is that you actually see the exchange taking place. And for the first time, pieces presented by the Royal Hawaiian delegation are side by side with things received or presented by the British Crown. So it's really striking to see these different works together in the space and the different levels of craftsmanship, the individual stories. It's really rich, really beautiful.
I can imagine, though, you will have certain items on display that have not been publicly exhibited for, gosh, you know, a very long time.
Too long. Absolutely. So the last exhibition about Hawaii that took place here was in 1975. Since then, there's been, you know, important loans out, including to the Bishop Museum, in fact, in 2010, where the large Ki'i of Ku returned for an exhibition on the reunification of the Ku in Hawaiian Hall. So some important mea kupuna and mea vaivai in general, contemporary pieces too, have been on display here and there, but not gathered in a single large exhibition. So we're really excited about this show. I think it really sheds light on this incredible incredible collection that is here that is so important that people in community have seen behind the scenes as they've come and visited, and we've been so privileged to host them. But it's a different experience to see them in the light, when, you know, side by side with absolutely stunning plinth and lighting and texture. So yeah, really exciting. I could go on and on.
Well, you know, I understand too that there will also be the display of the cape that was gifted to the king way back when.
Yes, so in 1810, Kamehameha I sent a letter to the British Crown requesting support from the Crown. And together with this letter, he sent a very large ahuula that remains in the collections of the Royal Collection Trust, but lives physically at the British Museum on long-term loan. So for the first time in history, we are bringing this large ahuula that is the largest Hawaiian ancestral cloak known today out, and we're bringing it out and bringing it side by side with the letter that is signed by Kamehameha I and sent to George III. By the time these two elements got here, so the ahuula and the letter, got to the UK, it was 1812, and by that time George IV was Prince Regent. So it's George IV indeed who received them. So in that space you will see the very large ahuula of sent by Kamehameha III facing the coronation surcoat of George IV, as if this meeting was taking place in the gallery.
And then talk about what this exhibit means to you personally, just because, you know, you were here working at Bishop Museum and you bring a sensitivity around these items and around the relationship to this exhibit.
I think for me, this exhibit is pure excitement. There is joy. There is that feeling that there's a bridge that exists between Hawaii and the UK. And I'm just very excited to celebrate with community members that are, in fact, some of them currently flying and on the planes coming our way. So I'm just thrilled to be able to see this takes place. And I'm really honored as well. It's been such a great privilege to work with so many people in the community, you know, practitioners, artists, scholars, linguists. Obviously, our exhibition stewardship group was crucial to putting this exhibition together. So Umi Kai, Noel Kahanu, Leah Caldera, Jonelle Pacaro, you know, helped us shape the show, but so many others in community. So excitement and feeling honored and so grateful.
Well, I think we are grateful that you have been open to inclusion at the table as this exhibit is being presented to the general public there. I guess maybe talk more about that inclusion.
Yes, my work over the years has always focused on the articulation between community practices and museum practices in the Pacific, specifically in Oceania. And I think building from the learnings and experiences at the Bishop Museum, where obviously working with community is so crucial in this part of everything that institution does, and it's in the DNA of this institution that was, you know, created in honor of Pauahi. Taking that energy into this space here at the British Museum, I think, is really important. It's something that is really powerful to do in this time because museum practices are shifting. We're understanding that there are different ways of knowing and experiencing the collections. And I think it's been really incredible to witness here at the museum, at the British Museum, how excited colleagues have been to rethink the way they do things or to go further into that practice or simply to be the best they can be in those spaces. So there's been a lot of learning, and I'm sure a lot more learning to come too.
And talk about the catalog, because you helped pull that together, and I'm sure that was not an easy feat.
Yes, the catalog was a really amazing experience. So just like for the exhibition, I felt that it was really important that the catalog didn't center a unique curatorial voice and one that would come solely from the British Museum. And so we turned the catalog into this incredible object that gathers voices from across the community. So scholars, but also practitioners that look into different aspects of practice, of making, but also recount the stories that we're engaging with in the exhibition. And I think one of the most important gesture maybe of this catalog, I mean, the whole book, I'm just so happy about how it came together, But it's the last part, the last section of that book. In this last section, we've been able to bring together, working with colleagues here in the Oceania section of the British Museum, to bring together a full inventory of all the mea vaivai that we care for here at the British Museum. And that's around 950 works. And in this book, we publish every single of them with, you know, a short description or label and a photo. This information is available on Collections Online, which is our database online, but we felt that it was important to have it in a printed form, in a book, in an object that people in Hawaii could have at home, could look through, and that serving as a resource moving forward. So we really hope that this catalog will be a resource for generations to come, and we're looking forward to hearing what people have to say about it. And learn some more.
Well, I'm sure our listeners, now that this will be on their radar, might figure a trip to London to see this exhibit. But certainly, if somebody wants to get their hands on this catalog, will it be available locally?
Yes, so we're very pleased that University of Hawaii Press is a co-publisher for the catalog. So the catalog for the exhibition, Hawaii, A Kingdom Crossing Oceans, will be available in Hawaii. That was a really important thing for us. So yes, I hope people will buy it and enjoy it. And of course, there are copies also available here in the UK when people come visit.
I bet you just can't wait until next week, you know, when all this gets unveiled to the public. And the folks with Hawaii ties that are living there in London, I'm sure, are eager to see this exhibit.
Yes, absolutely. People from various communities from across the Pacific are rallying. And of course, again, people jumping on planes as we speak to come for the opening. I think there's also going to be quite a few people, I hope, visiting before May 25th, which is the closing date. So we have a long way to go, and we're really excited to welcome as many people from Hawaii as possible here.
Well, Elise, thank you so much for your time this morning, and I'm excited to see the exhibit. Anything else you want to leave our listeners with? Because I think there's just going to be this sense of pride that Hawaii will be presented in this fashion.
Yeah, I'm not wanting to put words in their mouth. We're here to hold the space. We hope that people will feel proud. We hope that they will feel inspired. We hope that this, in a way, honors this long-lasting relationship. But also, we hope that it will carrying it forward, really, and into the future. I'm just excited to see how people experience it and how you feel as you are also coming away in just a few days.
Yes, yes, can't wait. Do you have a favorite item, artifact, in this exhibit?
This is the hardest question. I think for me, the bringing together of the ahu'ula of, you know, sent by Kamehameha I, together with the letter, is probably one of the most powerful moment in the exhibition, just to witness these two elements coming together. I find that really exceptional. But yes, there's just so many incredible works. There is probably the smallest piece in the exhibition is a tiny little honu carved in Palawa. And she may be the smallest, but she is absolutely exquisite.
All right. Well, can't wait to see it. But thank you so much, Elise. Thanks again. Mahalo.
Mahalo, Catherine.
And that was Elise Kristoff, curator for Oceania at the British Museum. We talked with her this morning about a new show highlighting Hawaii's history and its diplomatic relationship with Great Britain. Look for special stories around the exhibit here on The Conversation in the weeks to come. The exhibit officially opens to the public a week from tomorrow. We'll have links on our website later today. We have to go now, but up tomorrow we plan to hear about Remitau, People of the Ocean, a film that debuted at the Hawaii International Film Festival. It's to screen on Maui this month. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.